Hi, Cameron Wilson with you for a feature program on mental health today on Bush Telegraph. You're on RN and Radio Australia. Today for Mental As, we look at depression and mental illness in rural Australia. Later in the program, I'll be discussing the community support and services for people who suffer mental illness in rural and remote Australia. And we'll try to get a better understanding of how isolation can contribute to depression and other issues. That's all ahead. But first, let's hear one farmer's personal account of his struggles with depression.
I'm Chris Wilson, farmer from Wattabadgeri in New South Wales. I guess when I realised I was suffering depression, it was... it was a long way down the track for me. I'd had an ache inside for years that I didn't understand and I wasn't happy about, but I just felt that, that's my lot in life, you know. I haven't been dealt as good a hand as I thought. But then that feeling grew to consume me, and I knew that I was hiding a secret the way I was living my life. I was, you know, incredibly down and lethargic and, you know, full of apathy and just couldn't do things at home. But then when I go out, life would be good, I'd be large, and so I lived this double life for a long time. But after a while, it started to consume me, and then I realised that, you know, actually it was depression that I was going through. And then it was the realisation that, all right, if I can get this treated, that's probably good. But it was pretty frightening to contemplate the whole idea of getting treatment. That was really frightening.
So was it a situation that crept up on you more than just a sudden onset?
Yeah, absolutely. For me, it really was like a long, slow walk into cold water. And it was, you know, in that sense, it's always slightly painful, but you're up to your neck before you realise you're in trouble. And that's where I was.
Yeah. What period are we talking? Years?
Yeah. I actually, it was probably 15 years that I went untreated. And in that time, I sort of recognised three completely different periods of depression where I sort of was bouncing in and out of a low state. But ultimately, I'd hit a real rock bottom and then slowly come good again and life would come, you know, would be okay, but I'd be untreated. And then stress would enter my life again through just normal factors of life. And I'd crash, and I'd crash 10 times harder each time. And so each successive bout of depression for me was stronger and deeper and probably more frightening than anything.
At your worst moments, did you contemplate suicide?
I certainly, I guess you could say I contemplated it. Towards the end, I started to appreciate what people went through with suicide. Prior to that, I always thought anyone who committed suicide was weak and I really had no respect for them because, you know, my brother had died and I'd seen what that pain can do to a family. But when I got low, I realised, you know, I'd be driving along in the ute or laying around at home and the thought of, you know, ending my life actually would bring this sense of calm and a bit of peace within me. And you'd actually feel quite good and you think, holy crap, this is probably not a bad idea. But then again, because my brother had died, which was the basis for my depression, there was no way I could ever put my family through it. So I never actually really designed any situation like that, but I certainly felt the tantalising effect of, you know, relief from this inner pain.
But before you'd opened up and told your family, your friends that you were suffering depression, how much do you think they knew about the situation?
I thought they had no idea. Look, to be honest, most of them didn't know. The few people I thought that sort of must have had a bit of an idea that they knew that I wasn't well or that I was down a lot of the time, you know, later on when I talked to them about it, they would say that, look, we had no idea. And so ultimately they were just being good mates. You know, I'd be sort of a bit flat and they'd invite me around, come around and stay, come and hang out for a while and, you know, I get to escape my lonely existence. That was just...
Hi, I'm here to see Simon Sellers.
Come on, come here,
Thanks.
Can I get your tea?
Hi, I'm Simon Sellers.
I'm fine, thanks.
I'm an accountant in Wagga for Boyce Chartered Accountants. I've known Chris since about 1990 when I started university here.
So you met him in uni days. What sort of character was he when you met him?
He's no really different to now. He's, you know, life of the party, always willing to give anything a crack. So I don't think he's changed at all, really.
Yeah. He strikes me as the sort of bloke that you, particularly in the younger days, you'd probably go out and have a couple of drinks with and have quite a good night.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Definitely have a good night with Willow, no matter, and still happens today. Yeah, I don't think he's changed, actually. That's why some girls say that he looks only 35 rather than 40, whatever he is.
I was trying to work that out. I know he's in his 40s, but he does look in his 30s, doesn't he?
Yeah. He's got that shaggy kind of surfy kind of cool look.
So you you eventually left town for work. At what point was that?
So that was in 1994. So in November 1994, after being in Wagga here for 4 years, Willow actually helped me move all my worldly belongings across from Wagga to Cooma in his Land Cruiser. And so, yeah, I left in November 1994 and had 5 years in Cooma and then 3.5 in Moree, and then came back here in 2003 to set up this business. And probably over that time that I was in Cooma and Moree, we certainly in contact with each other, but obviously didn't see as much physically of each other. And he, you know, he had girlfriends at the time and was doing other things. I'd moved into a relationship and got married in Moree and started a family and those types of things. And whilst he's, has been single that most of that time, apart from some girlfriends in between, probably leading a bit different lives. Yeah. So it was a bit harder. But, you know, whenever we can catch up, we will.
So the point when you, back when you could get all of your worldly possessions into a Land Cruiser, into the back of a Land Cruiser, when you left, do you have any thoughts about Chris's mental health? Were there any signs that he was struggling?
No, not at all. I mean, probably in 1994, I reckon he's probably at the peak of his powers type of thing. So things were going well for him. You know, I think that he was moved into they'd purchased Oivy, the farm, and he'd moved over there and was running it and still young and fit and, you know, snowboarding and skiing and water skiing and doing pretty much everything that he wanted to do. So I didn't detect any unhappiness at that point in time at all. I think he was pretty much on a high.
Yeah. And I guess from a distance, when you keep in contact while you're away, it would have been tough to pick up on anything?
Yeah, it was. I mean, there's only the only time that I really worried about him, I suppose, was when he broke up with one of his girlfriends, and that affected him pretty severely. And so I'd never seen him, you know, kind of fall so hard for a girl. And then both when they were going out, and then she went overseas and he was, you know, finding it difficult. And also then when she broke it up, you know, I probably then was the first indication that he wasn't as happy as perhaps what I thought he might have been.
But over those years, if you look back now, given what you know, were there any signs? Was he harder to drag out sometimes? Did he invite you? Was he less inclined to invite you around to his place? Anything like that?
No, I guess I don't think there was. I mean, probably you look back and when you see people that are high all the time, or, you know, in high, such high spirits, you do wonder wonder what's actually happening. Mm-hmm. When they're not high on spirits, when they're actually home alone or by themselves. Yeah. Because it seems to be there's a lot of people who do get a bit, you know, kind of manic, you know, with depression. They get some really big highs, but their lows are lows. So yeah. Maybe I would have with my maturity now and understanding now, but probably not really. I didn't really pick up unless he told me about it. I wouldn't have probably picked it up.
Yeah. How did you find out that he had been in such a bad way?
He told me, yeah, and so he told me that he'd been seeing someone because he hadn't been happy, and I guess that was a big, since that point in time he's been able to communicate quite openly about where he's at ever since then, which has been really great. Yeah, and I only feel sometimes I wish I had a little bit more time because with him to actually support, so I do make an effort to as a friend to try and be there and try and contact him and make sure that he's okay and that he's got someone to talk to. Yeah,
but when he told you, what was your reaction? Were you annoyed at him for not letting you know, or were you sympathetic?
Sympathetic would be the main thing, is that, to not have recognised that to not have that understanding of not to have seen it, probably you feel a bit bad that you didn't recognise it, so you could have helped earlier. Or at the same time, say, you know, why didn't you communicate that earlier? If we, you know, that would have been really good to understand. Because yeah. I just feel there's probably times where, yeah, I probably could have given more to him, you know. Yeah.
Has it affected you or changed your outlook, your perspective on things at all, to know that you can have a good mate that how you think they're experiencing life is so different to what's actually going on?
Yeah, it's scary. That part that men in particular, but then women, I think anyone, you know, anyone hasn't got the confidence to be able to open their heart and let them know exactly what they're feeling. Yeah. And I think that, you know, it comes down to probably relationships between, you know, the relationships we have with each other, you know, and particularly with your partner. If you have to hide things or not have the confidence to speak openly with someone, then it makes it harder on the relationship. But if you can be completely open and honest about mm-hmm. how you are feeling, and the better we get it, more confident we get with that, and if people don't judge you harshly for being quite open about how you're feeling, I think that the better things will be.
So now, what's your role, or what do you see your role is now in your relationship with Chris?
It's just to be his mate, you know, just to be there as a friend to support and to know that always got his best interests at heart and want him to be as happy, and where I can help try and if I can at all help him find direction or help him, you know, be positive and happy in his life. That's all I can really do.
I've come out to Chris's property. It's about 35 or 40 minutes out of Wagga Wagga, and Chris is just up in one of the top paddocks, just up the hill a bit from here. He's in a tractor spraying a paddock of wheat. So I'm just going to go and jump in the tractor with him and find out a bit more about his story.
Come on, pick a line.
Oh, touch
the fence.
Is that all right?
Yeah. I was looking at it. We call that the tree effect. Like you see on the growing tree. And
there's a rabbit there. Right there. Yeah. And another one.
Yeah, look at the little buggers. Actually are doing quite well.
So you could, I guess, busy times of the year though, you could spend hours on end in this cabin here on your own.
Oh, yeah. This thing's got lights. I can be out here all night doing this. But the job gets done, so you don't mind it. But it can get lonely, and it can get and it can be hard to stay out here all night when you're tired. But that's the job I do. You know, if you get tired too bad, you've got to work.
Yeah, but I imagine if your health's not too good, you're suffering from depression, you come out here for hours on end on your own in the dark, it doesn't strike me as the ideal working conditions.
It's I guess it's not. But you see, I'd actually prefer to be out here doing something than being at home in the hole, watching television or trying to sleep. Or this would actually take my mind off things and I would get things done. The thing that, you know, would probably make it difficult was making the decision to actually come out and do the spraying, or what to sow and how much to sow and when to sow, and just getting out and actually enacting something. Like, it was difficult to make decisions because I'd be constantly second-guessing myself or worried that I'd get it wrong, or just apathy. Can't actually get off my bum and make the decision.
Yeah.
You know, and all it is just a decision. Make it. Get on with it.
So the house was the bad spot.
Yeah, very much so. So some days, like if I had a big weekend out with my friends, having a great old time, and I would have a sensational time, I'd come home on, say, a Sunday, and I'd crash, turn the television on, and then probably sit in front of that for the next couple of days. It might be about Tuesday when I'd get out, and I'd be loathing about not being out doing something, or at least having a look around my farm. for hours and hours on end. When I'd finally get out, it might be 4 o'clock on a Tuesday, and the daylight would make me instantly feel better. And just driving around the farm, you'd instantly feel loads better. And then you'd realise it's too late to do anything. I've no point starting anything. I can't get a mob of sheep in because there's nothing to do. So then you'd turn around and I'd get to the top of the hill above the house and I'd see that damn house. And it would drive me insane. I've got to go back down there. It's like going back into the hole. And I hated it. But in I'd go and I'd be there till probably lunchtime the next day. At least I'd get out earlier. And off I'd go. I'd get a bit of work done, and the next day I'd be inspired, and away I'd go. So I'd come out of the trough then, and I'd still feel like crap, but I'd actually be back working again, and I'd be good for a few days. And then probably the weekend would come along, I'd go out, have way too much fun, come home, crash, start the cycle again.
So what, from Sunday morning to 4 o'clock Tuesday when you got off the couch, what would you have done in that time?
Sit there, just sit and watch television and say to myself, I'll get up here in a minute, I'll head outside after this show. And I'd hate what I was watching. Television drives me insane, I don't even like it. I'd fall asleep. I'd sit there thirsty. I'd sit there thirsty, busting for a drink. And this might be 10 o'clock in the morning. Might be 4 o'clock in the afternoon before I actually go and get one. Just couldn't move. It was like when I turned the television on, I'd be stunned. Someone would hit me between the eyes and that's it. I'd just switch off. Couldn't move. Just sit there. Yeah. Coming out here and getting some daylight and enjoying myself and doing what I knew I always loved, which is farming. And actually when I was depressed, I hated my farm and I hated the fact that I was a farmer. And I felt that I needed to sell the farm to get out of my troubles. Somewhere deep in my psyche, I knew that if I sold my farm, I'd be like a ship without an anchor. And it would ruin me. I would probably end up swinging from a tree somewhere because I'd had nothing to identify with, nothing to say who I was. Because I've always known I'm a farmer. Growing up on a farm, I was always going to be a farmer. And when I got healthy, my love for farming came back. And, and I'm so happy and relieved that I didn't make a stupid decision and sell my business.
How you feel about the house now?
It needs some work. I need to do a bit of maintenance on it. And but yeah, look, I don't mind going back to my house. It is actually quite a nice house. Clearly, you've seen it. It's probably more of a bachelor pad than a house.
Yeah, but you don't sit at the top of the hill anymore and dread going back home?
No, I don't loathe my house anymore, actually. I do actually quite like my existence, and as much as I've realised I still love my farm, I actually do like my house, and I like where I live. I love my neighbours. We live in a great area, which I'm sure most farming areas are sensational for local people as well, and Wantabadgery is particularly good.
So I've just had a chat with Chris and got much more of an insight into what he's been through over the years and how he went about keeping it a secret from everyone. And I'm just about to get into my car now and drive off to see his mum. And I'm looking at that house he was talking about, the red brick house. Modest house, probably 3-bedroom house, tin roof, red brick, white window sills, water tank on the right-hand side from where I'm standing. Some washing hanging there, a couple of trees around it as well. I'm just trying to imagine what it was like for Chris to stand here a few years back and what he was feeling when he looked at exactly what I'm looking at now. I'll go and talk to his mum, find out a little bit more.
Sorry, that's okay.
You're coming in.
Oh, okay. Right, I'll give you a ring.
Yeah.
Okay.
I need to see you.
I will, Pam.
Thanks.
Okay, righto.
Hi, I'm Bernadette Wilson and I'm Chris's mum.
What sort of little kid was Chris?
He was a wild little bugger. He was very determined. He and his bigger brother, who's only 11 and a half months older, they used to fight like mad. And Chris used to win a lot of them. He was very strong-minded. You'd tell him to do something, but he still did what he wanted to do when he was little.
So Chris was one. Was it one of five boys or one of five kids all up?
One of five children all up. It was three boys. Chris is number two. And then number four was our daughter, Joelle. And number five was Matt, our youngest one.
Yeah. So at what point did you get a sense that he was struggling with his mental health?
We didn't see it. When he was I don't know whether he's told you, but he was with Matt, our youngest son that was killed. He came home from boarding school and those school holidays, and they were actually watching the cricket. And I said, come on, you boys, get out and get down there and go and work. So off they went, and Matt was to go and give some hay, but he was told not to shut the gate, and he did. He got out of the tractor and shut the gate, but the tractor rolled back and crushed him. So Christopher actually found him. He couldn't work out where he was. And I can just remember I was gardening outside, and I just heard the car come flying up and this screaming and screaming. And I sort of couldn't quite believe it. I really don't remember too much more after that for a while.
Oh, yeah, well, that, you know. Yeah, that whole event was incredibly tragic. I don't know. It's a long time ago now, but I remember calling on the radio saying, you've got to get over here, I think I raced home, actually. But, yeah, that whole experience was shocking.
But yet, as you say, you didn't grieve at the time because you had the plans to go overseas. So what did you just push it out of your mind?
Oh, look, no, at that stage, before I went away, I was grieving and life was horrible. I hated the farm. Instantly, I hated the farm and hated what was going on in my life. And you'd wake up every morning feeling heavy and sad and bewildered, you know. So, you know, but things, I guess, were getting better. And then there was this opportunity to go travelling again. You know, we just ran the travel agent or whatever and delayed my flights. And, you know, so then the opportunity was coming that I was going to go overseas. So I started working towards that. And so that was good. So it was escapism, really.
When he came back, I'll never forget, he walked in the door and he said, "This is a shrine to Matt." Because I had got my photos up and I had photos of Matt everywhere and, you know, lots of things. But, of course, we had been grieving and getting through it and he hadn't grieved. And then we had this other farm, so he moved down and lived in this house on his own and he didn't live with us. So I don't know, at that stage he wasn't in the state of depression, I don't think. I think it was a bit later when he had a girlfriend and he thought that this was going to be the one, but he wanted her to have a little trip overseas to be ready to settle down to be a married farmer's wife. But anyway, it didn't work, and I think that's when he started his depression.
Okay, so there's two quite separate events here. Yes. It sounds like you think him witnessing Matt's death was quite... has been quite a critical factor, has it? It's been its influence.
Because he still doesn't talk about it to us, and I don't want to upset him to ask him, if you know what I mean. Mm. I feel I know what he's been through because I know what I've been through, or what we have been through, the whole family and my husband and all of us. And I really think that it was. That was going to not help for him to talk. I don't know whether that was the right thing to do or not. That's the thing.
Do you think, in hindsight, do you wonder if he should have stayed rather than than go
really
overseas?
Yes, we should have told him to stay, but we thought at the time we were doing the right thing. Yeah. So I don't know. You know, it was just, it all sort of became very hard. He would make, you know, sometimes he wouldn't turn up or he'd be away or he'd be seem to be quiet, and my husband would say, oh, you know, he should be doing this and he should be doing, but I kept making excuses for him because I just felt deep down he had a lot, you know, to carry.
So at this point, when you were starting to question whether it was his mental health or why he wasn't acting in a way you might expect, was that after the breakup with his his girlfriend?
Yes, it was. And it wasn't until quite a lot longer, because we actually bought the farm out where he is now and he was still working there, and that's when my husband could see that he wasn't, you know, perhaps doing everything he should. And I'd go out there to, you know, do his house and so forth, and I'd see him reading and I'd think, oh, well, he's... I kept making excuses for him. I just... But he just never talked to us, and I just assumed that he was okay, because I'd ask him, are you okay? Yeah, I'm fine. But then when our daughter came home, she came home to do another course here in Wagga, and she couldn't stand it. She said, oh, I can't bear to live with you people. She came to live with us, you know. You fight too much, your TV's too loud, I'm going out to live with Chris. So she moved out to Chris. And she was out there for a month or so. Oh, I can't stand living with him, he's this and he's that and so. But that is when she saw it, because she was living with him.
My sister's wonderful, but she did actually, she started to notice when my cracks were showing. We went to a big party together and she obviously observed my behaviour. And then the next morning, she confronted me and said, you know, what on earth's going on here?
What were you doing?
Well, look, I don't really know, but I just know that with inside myself, I was just more erratic and not being as, I don't know, coherent or something. There was, I was just playing up too much, but it just didn't seem right. And I knew I wasn't right, obviously, but so she tried to confront me about it, and she did. And I think by that stage, I was frightened enough to know that I needed to actually let someone know what was going on. So I told her about it and just said, look, I think I'm depressed, and you know, and I don't know what to do and all the rest, and yeah, I'm spiraling out of control. And she said, well, that's no problem. Why don't we just go and see someone? Let's ring up a psychologist or someone and make an appointment. I guess internally I panicked at that stage, because all of a sudden it was like, hang on, I'm not ready to confront my demons yet. You know, it's a big enough step for me this morning just to say, well, I've got a problem. And that was the first time I'd ever told anyone that I had an issue. So I made an excuse about my dogs were barking or something like that, and I took off. Hang on a sec. And I went outside and I jumped in the ute and took off. So
So she'd pushed you to the point, or tried to force you to confront the issue, and you'd acknowledged it, and then got on your bike.
Yeah. Well, to confront my issue was to add more stress to my life, and at this stage I couldn't handle stress. Anything that confronted my life. Like even, you know, answering telephone calls and doing book work or doing things that I didn't really enjoy would be a big stress and I would struggle to manage. So to actually sit down and you know, get proactive about getting help was a huge stress, and it was just too confronting for me. So I had to avoid it. Well, I felt I had to avoid it. And then I guess I went along for about another 3 months knowing that I should do something about it. Often I would actually open the phone book up and just flick through the pages and get to psychologists or something in the yellow pages and go, oh, yeah. But I couldn't do anything about it. There was no way I could actually ring someone. I just, you know, it was just too confronting. So about 3 months after the first time, my sister Joelle pulled me up. This time she went around the house and locked all the doors and windows and said, right, I've locked you in, you're not going anywhere, we're doing something about this morning. And I think I just, it was like I just put a white flag up. I just said, yeah, all right, I'm over it. I'm too tired. I can't, I just can't do this anymore. Mm. Bugger it. What have I got to lose? I feel like, you know, feel bad. I've got to do something. So, yeah, so we just, look, we just looked up psychologists in the phone book. Technically, it's the wrong way to go about it. I should have gone to my GP first and all the rest, but look, I didn't care. I just wanted help. Yeah. So, and it seemed like the only way to go about it. So we looked them up and I just randomly ran my finger down through the list. You know, I had no idea who I was really looking at. I'd seen all those names before and I hadn't made a choice. I don't know why I chose the psychologist that I did. But I made a call and the lady at the other end of the line, the receptionist, asked me who referred me. And I said, oh, well, my sister. And there was a pause at the other end of the line and she said, are you going to be all right? And I said, yeah, fine. She said, well, it's going to take a couple of weeks. And I said, look, that'll be fine. No worries. Thank you. Goodbye. And I remember at this stage, I hung up the phone and I turned around to my sister and I started crying. And I just said, you've just saved my life. And she really did. I just couldn't cope any longer. I just couldn't do it anymore. I was finished. I was done.
So can, just the string of events here, we've got the accident with Matt, we've mm-hmm. got the breakup of his of Chris's mm-hmm. relationship, and then we've got his sister coming to stay. Are we spanning years, months? What sort of time frame are we talking?
Years. It'd be 8 or 9 years or so, 8 or 9 years between that. And that's what Harry and I feel so bad that we actually didn't pick up his depression. He's very good at hiding things. I think a lot of them are, from what I've heard. I don't know, but, you know, and we both feel really bad that we didn't actually pick it up before.
So would you describe it as Chris's mental state as a slow decline, more than a sudden fall off a cliff, if you like?
Yes, probably. But then whenever he was with us, he's always bright, see? And this is with the whole thing. He just didn't show it in front of anyone. Mm.
But you must have suspected something if you felt to ask if he was okay.
Well, deep down I was always worried, you know, that something, you know, I was hoping that he would be all right. Not that we asked very often, but he would, you know, just, he'd say, yeah, I'm okay. So he wouldn't say anything. And I just took it for granted that he is okay.
But why do you think you were so keen or so ready to make excuses for him when there must have, from what you're saying, you were seeing things that he was not the same Chris?
Because of the burden he was carrying, because I was carrying the burden of losing a son. And I didn't want to, I just felt he deep down was carrying that. I didn't realise it was so much the girlfriend at the time. As time came on, he did tell us that it was, you know, that he was upset about that. But it was because of having lost my son, and I didn't want to make him feel bad because I didn't want to think that he was to blame that had happened. And that's the big thing. I didn't want him to take the blame. So I was always making excuses for him.
Mm. Mm. So it was easier not to have a conversation
yes.
than...
Yes, it was. Yeah, yeah.
Have you ever considered why he was so keen to hide the depression, why he wouldn't come out and ask?
No. And even now he doesn't talk about it. I only hear it when we go to the Riverina Bluebell meetings and he gets up and talks.
Doesn't talk to you about it?
No, he still won't. No, he doesn't. We don't talk about it here. No. He's... I don't know what it is, but... It's just something he'd, you know, he just doesn't talk about.
Would you prefer if he did?
Well, maybe yes, but as long as he's happy. If he doesn't want to talk about it, I'm happy that he doesn't talk. I don't want to make him talk about it. put it that way.
Yeah.
I don't know whether he would. I just feel perhaps he might think that it's going to make us sad again or something, and I don't want to make him, you know, sad, because he's, you know, he's such a beautiful boy.
Yeah, once I put it out there that I and got an appointment, I had nothing to hide. So I let my family know first, and I was comfortable with that. And then I used to sneak to my appointments with my psychologist. And then once she sort of let me go and said, look, you know, I only probably went half a dozen times. That was the other thing. It wasn't much. She said, you need to be on your own now. You can work this out. And then once I got my own confidence in it and I realised how good I felt, I did actually start telling the world, because it was... I realise there's so many other people out there just bobbing along under the surface, you know, existing in life, and yet all they need is someone to reach down and lift them up and say, look, come on, let's go and do this, and they can get their life back too. So,
when your daughter said, we've had it out with, me and Chris have had it out, Chris and I have had it out, I better correct myself, my mother would pull me up on that, Chris and I have had it out and he's come clean, he's suffering depression. Did everything fall into place? Did everything make sense to you?
He was a different person. He was a lot brighter. It's as if he had a load off his shoulders. We noticed it when we came back, and we noticed it before Joelle told us that he'd been. He'd walked in, it must have been the same day we came home, but we noticed he was a different person, so it was as if, you know, a load had been taken off his shoulders.
Who was the hardest person to tell?
Probably myself, to be really honest. Being honest with myself and actually admitting that I had a problem, I reckon that was my hardest one. Amongst my family and friends, no, just I didn't care. But it was once I accepted it in myself, and ultimately my recovery was me accepting that it was okay to feel down and that it was okay to have a crap day, and that I didn't need to beat myself up about it. And I guess that's what used to drive me into these holes. I used to get quite upset with myself that, you know, I had this ache and I'd actually drive myself down. Once I realised it was all right, it evaporated.
Chris Wilson, who's a farmer at Wanabadgeri in the Riverina of New South Wales. My thanks to Chris and his mum Bernadette, and also his friends. I spoke to a handful of his friends, and you'll hear some of their stories up on our website later this afternoon if you want to head there for some more information. You're listening to Bush Telegraph. Cameron Wilson with you, RN and Radio Australia. Well, let's look at some of the issues around rural mental health services that were raised there in Chris's story. I'm joined by Alison Fairley, who's from the Mental Illness Fellowship in North Queensland, also a social media campaigner on mental health issues. I'm also joined by Dr. Fiona Shand, who's a clinical psychologist and a research fellow at the Black Dog Institute, and Trevor Hazel, senior programs manager at the Centre for Rural and Remote Mental Health. Look, thank you to all of you for listening in there and for joining us. Alison, I want to start with you if I could. What is it about Chris's story that resonates with you?
How honest he was. I think for everybody in their journey, the most important point is recognising that they have to admit it to themselves first. You know, you can have all the services in the world, but if people are not going to acknowledge that they need help or support, it's not going to work. So I really appreciated it. I wrote his highs and lows as he told that story. I loved it from the tractor cab. I thought to myself of all of the farmers that I've met through social media who break down that isolation of the tractor cab through Twitter and social media. But I thought also the fact that farmers love that isolation. That's what makes them do what they do. So it's not necessarily a bad thing, and there are ways to get around it.
Yeah, I was struck when we were sitting there and spraying this paddock of wheat. It was a beautiful day and all the canola was in flower. It was just a stunning place to be. But I couldn't help thinking that if you weren't in the right frame of mind, if you were struggling with a mental health issue, here you are on your own, hours on end out in the paddock. It would be tough.
It'd be incredibly tough. And I think the darkness that you mentioned, at nighttime particularly, you know, some of them have got their music going, they've got all sorts of things happening in that tractor cab, but at the end of the day, you've got your thoughts. And, you know, having been through depression myself, I know how those thoughts can be your worst enemy. And when you start concentrating on the negative, it can really take you down and you start to go to some very dark places. He's remarkable. His story is amazing, that he is opening up and speaking to so many people about it.
Without revealing too much, can you tell us a little bit more about your own experience?
Oh, sure. Look, I've lived with depression for, gosh, it'd be almost 15 years now, or more actually. It would be, let's put another 7 years on that, because that's how long it took me to get some help. I was a little bit like him. For me, it was about recognizing that I had a problem. And once I did that, that was the biggest hurdle to jump. I still suffer with depression now. I go through various bouts of that, but I have support networks around me to help me when I go through it. But even then, as a mental health advocate, I sometimes have trouble admitting when I'm not traveling so well. It's about, for me, a sense of personal failure, and it shouldn't be, but it's a very real barrier to stop people getting the help that they need. But gee, I when he talked about that house, I get that totally, because it becomes like a prison. And once you put the TV on, the TV is like, it numbs you. It numbs everything around you. And so you don't feel the pain as acutely. You don't feel happiness or good stuff either, but it takes away that really aching pain a little bit. And so it's like a numbing effect.
But Alison, is there anything that's associated with living in a rural area or a remote area that affects your mental health or influences how you experience depression?
I think that there are tremendous pressures on people. And I think the fact that there's also a lot of stigma around mental health can be a huge issue too. I loved how Chris said that he used to sneak around, to go see the psychologist. That doesn't surprise me at all. Mm. But well done to him, because he actually looked up the Yellow Pages and there were psychologists available. You know, one of the best points of call that people can do is go to their GP first. And even in our most remote areas, there are GPs. There may not be psychologists, but there are GPs who can start helping to point people in the right direction. And I'm sure, you know, our colleagues here today will also share about some of the online options and telehealth options that are available to people to access. But yeah, it's still a huge social stigma.
Dr. Fiona Shan, you're a clinical psychologist. I assume you'd be familiar with this story of just doing everything you can to keep your mental health issue a secret from friends and family.
Yeah, look, I think that's right. And I think Chris's story was very powerful and very affecting. And he did a beautiful job of describing that vicious cycle and that slow decline of, you know, going out and pretending everything's okay and drinking a lot and then shutting down and withdrawing from activity and then feeling bad about that. And, and you know, it's a really nasty cycle that people get into. And what was lovely was to hear that Chris's sister was able to identify what was going on for him. And that's often the case, actually. We hear it a lot, particularly from men, that their family and their loved ones play a really important role in helping them to recognise what's going on and encouraging them to get help. And sometimes it does take people a long time to get to that point where...
8 years, is that unusual?
No, look, it's not particularly unusual. And even once people get into the health system, sometimes getting the right diagnosis can be tricky as well.
So what do you see as the role of friends and family then? We heard Chris's mum say that she'd ask, are you okay, and get the answer, yeah, I'm fine. So what is the role?
Yeah, and again, that's something that we hear quite often, that men will often deny that there is a problem. And yet they will also tell us that if people persist and they ask questions and they continue to say, look, we can see things are not right, that they will actually accept help. So the role of family and friends is absolutely critical, because it is a little bit like, as Chris described, you know, walking slowly into cold water, and you just get used to feeling bad and not recognise that things are so wrong. And sometimes it takes someone from the outside to actually see that. So it's absolutely critical.
Powerful description, that, wasn't it? Up to my neck before I noticed I was in
it.
Yeah. Trevor, you're from the Centre for Rural and Remote Mental Health, based in Orange. What do you think are the barriers to people generally, not just men, but people seeking help?
Well, I think Alison and Fiona have pretty well nailed it. The initial barrier to seeking help is within the person. It's a very difficult task to admit to oneself, because by the very nature of the illness, your perception, thoughts, negativity around those thoughts affects decision-making and problem-solving. And Chris described his problem with making even the simplest decisions or carrying out the simplest tasks. And to decide to go and get help is often just beyond the person. And that's why, you know, his sister played such a valuable role in saying, well, I'm going to help make this decision for you.
Trevor, if someone is in a really bad way, spiralling out of control, they might be suicidal. How much help are the telephone lines, the websites that we hear about to a person in a remote, isolated area that's in that situation?
Well, often those are the only services on the supply side that are available to them. And they're excellent. You know, the counselling services, where people just provide a service of listening and encouraging and helping people to identify how they can help themselves or how they can access care, they're excellent. But people have to access them. They have to know how to access them. They need to be able to have access to telephony, to the computer, etc.
Alison, when I was talking to Chris, he said these national organisations are great, had no problem with them, actually was highly complimentary of them. But he said when it comes to the local level needing help down the street or within my community, that's where I struggled. Now, he's now part of a group called Riverina Bluebell, which is locally focused. How effective do you think these national helpline services, these websites are for someone who's in a really bad way?
Look, I'll be honest with you, and I don't think that there's a lot of evidence out there to support the fact that people in rural and remote locations access a lot of those. I'm talking in our farming communities. Our farmers don't tend to like to pick up the phone and get onto a helpline. There's been research came out of the University of New England around that. I honestly believe that the best support networks for people in rural and remote locations are the communities themselves. They need to be equipped to look out after their fellow neighbours, their friends, their family. Lots of great news stories around mental health first aid being delivered in a lot of the communities, so people know how to intervene if somebody is having a mental health crisis as well. But also it's becoming mentally aware in those communities. And I think the best thing that these large organisations from outside can do is empower local communities to find the solutions that work for them.
We had a Facebook comment earlier in the week in response to a story we had on mental health. And this is the comment here. Stop insisting that the only way to prevent suicide is by telling people to recommend they go and talk to someone or ring services such as Lifeline. Fiona, does more need to be done at a local level? Or do we need other services, more options than just handing out these phone numbers?
Yeah, I think we do. I think we need to take a more systems-based approach and to implement that within a community or within a district. And that means not just services like Lifeline, which I think do a wonderful job, but also training GPs, training frontline health staff, running peer support programs in school, running screening programs, and making sure that people are offered the right kind of treatment if they do put their hand up for help. And I think Alison's hit the nail on the head that it isn't just health services that need to be involved in this, it's also communities and community services.
So starting in schools, you think really starting at a young age?
Yeah, so there's some evidence that screening in schools is effective and certainly not harmful. That's one of the big fears, that if we start talking to teenagers about suicide, that we might put ideas into their head. But what we know is they're already talking about it amongst themselves. So screening people in high school has been shown to have beneficial effects. And also peer support models in high school have also shown to be beneficial. So certainly I think starting in high school, given the evidence, is a great idea.
So is there this sense that, let's take the more extreme end of the scale where people have self-harmed or perhaps attempted suicide, is there really this need for a strong change in culture around the support for those people afterwards?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, we've just finished a project looking at the people's experiences of health services after they've had a suicide attempt. And I have to say the results are not looking all that great for our health services, so there really needs to be a strong change And that period after people have been released from hospital following a suicide attempt is really critical, and they need ongoing care and they need ongoing support, and people are falling through the cracks, unfortunately.
Trevor, do you agree with that view that GPs really need to be engaged in this process? We heard that point raised earlier in the week on Bush Telegraph.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, you know, if you look at the healthcare system, the majority of mental health services are provided in the private sector by GPs and by psychologists. And if they, you know, they really do need to make themselves more accessible by letting patients know that they can talk about these things. A very useful service on the Beyond Blues website is where you can look up a database to see GPs who are actually really comfortable talking about mental health issues. Mm. Unfortunately, we need more GPs to put themselves on that register, but just knowing that a GP is willing to talk about mental health is one of the ways of overcoming the barriers of opening up.
Trevor, we heard a statistic on Monday on Bush Telegraph that it was a study in Queensland that showed 40% of farmers who had actually committed suicide had sought help in the 3 months prior to suiciding. What does that tell you about the standard of service at the moment, or the effectiveness of service at the moment?
Well, I think it's not unusual that people who may be suicidal have other health problems. People with chronic back pain, for example, people with any chronic illness can have a mental illness as well and therefore be at risk of suicide. The issue is that people are focusing on their physical symptoms, and perhaps the healthcare system is focusing on their physical symptoms and presentations and not looking for the signs that the chronic illness or the pain may also be having an impact on the person's mental health, and that those symptoms need treatment as well.
If I can just quickly put a question to all of you. I'll start with you, Fiona. What influence do you think the rural lifestyle, and by that I mean the fact that farmers in particular have access to a means of suicide, whether that's a firearm or something else, what influence does that have on the higher rates of suicide amongst farmers?
Yeah, well, certainly we know that access to lethal means of suicide is particularly dangerous, and it's far more prevalent in rural communities. I think... Look, it depends. Some rural communities, there is a really strong sense of connection, but the problem when people get depressed is that they lose sight of that and they start to feel isolated. So I think that's a real issue. Access to services is also something of an issue, but probably not as big as we think it is. But that sense of isolation can be really dangerous when it's combined with an existing mental illness.
Alison, you told us how you've battled with depression for many years. We seem to be talking more and more about men in particular in rural areas. What about for a woman in a rural area? Does more attention need to be paid to women who are struggling?
It sure does. Look, our women carry a huge burden. Not only are they worried about their men, many of them, you know, really scared that their men won't come back at the end of the day. They are carrying the burden of caring for family, their children, as well as often doing all the accounts for their business, not to mention those that are farmers out there working alongside the men. And they get overlooked because the suicide rate is so much higher amongst the male farming population. But we do know that statistically, more women attempt suicide than men, and we can't ignore this. It's really important to put in place community support networks for our women.
That's a statistic that will surprise a lot of people, and we're going to look at mental health issues in rural women particularly on Friday. Trevor, quite quickly, if I could, the first thing that you think could be done to improve the service in rural Australia?
Well, I think we need to look at the strengths of rural communities. One of the big strengths is the community's willingness to look out for each other. There is a sense of shared risk, and it's when people do find that a neighbour is struggling, they're very understanding and they're very willing to try and help people. And I actually think what we can do is just build on that to normalise the experience of mental illness and the experience of seeking help, so that and even building the bridge between the individual person and the services by family, friends, workmates and other community members.
So a bit still to go. Trevor, thanks so much for sharing your thoughts today. Trevor Hazel, Senior Programs Manager for the Centre for Rural and Remote Mental Health. That's in Orange. Also, my thanks to Dr. Fiona Shan, Clinical Psychologist and Research Fellow at the Black Dog Institute, and Alison Fairley from the Mental Illness Fellowship in North Queensland and Social Media Campaign. And my thanks to Alison as well. Also, a big thanks to Chris Wilson and his family for sharing their story, and Kathy Pryor for producing that story today. If you want to hear more, some more interviews from Chris's friends, go to the website this afternoon. We'll have a detailed report up there on the Bush Telly website. That's Bush Telly for today. Stay on RN.
Sensors are everywhere these days, and they're even spreading across the farm. On Future Tense this week, we take a look at a project called Sense-T, which has been testing methods for data collection on 20 farms in Tasmania, looking for ways to improve productivity. It's all part of a growing move toward data-driven farming. So join me on Future Tense. Download the program from the RN website or look for us on iTunes.